What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Kropczyk. And John, the fifth domain, not to be confused with that group that sang Up, Up, and Away.
Oh, yeah, it's the fifth dimension.
Ah, there you go. We don't want to confuse that. Though they're still out there. I just saw where they were playing in our area soon. So
wow.
The fifth dimension survives. No, we're talking about the fifth domain. Well, let me explain that because it's a little bit confusing. But once you get the concept, it'll stay with you forever. We start on land with the Army.
Right.
And then we go to the sea with the Navy.
Right.
And then the air with the Air Force. And now we're told we're going to have a Space Corps.
Yes.
But the fifth domain, in terms of where a lot of hot wars may start in a rather cold, antiseptic way, is cyber.
Yeah.
Cyber
attacks.
That's a
scary place.
Yeah, it's very invisible. Now, John,
because
you
so
dwell
much,
in that domain an
so,
awful lot.
So much of our information is on the fifth domain.
Well, not only our information. I mean, think about it.
Our whole life.
What about the electric grid or the way our air controllers control what's going on in the sky?
Right. You're right.
So if those things are intercepted.
So connected.
Well, think about it, John. Here in the state of Connecticut, where we come from, I mean, there was a period about 6-7 years ago when we lost our power for, what was it, 4 or 5 days?
Yeah, almost a week, yep.
And people were frantic. No, seriously.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
Life did not exist in the form that we knew it previous to that.
Right, that's right.
It was amazing. So, when you think about the potential for what a cyber attack could do to our nation, it is really, really scary. And the Pentagon views this as a theater of war. The Pentagon, in all of their writings, not to be confused with a place where we go to see war movies, a theater of war, all right? So this is serious stuff that we're talking about. They think that the next major war is likely to be provoked by a cyber attack.
Well, we've already had that. I mean, we've had, who was it? Was it the Israelis attacked
the Iranians? Well, we helped with SUSNET,
To slow down their nuclear
exactly.
program.
Development,
and,
yeah.
So, I mean, this is already going on, and it's been going on for a long time. So I can only see it getting worse.
Well, the thing is, you know, it's interesting because the issues of offense and defense are really at play here. So you think about it, the Russians could probably do what they want with our electric grid, and they have gone in and played around. We've seen that in a few instances. We, of course, look, we're not that late to the dance either in the offensive capability. So we could probably, well, I'm sure we could do the same to them.
China's a big player.
Exactly. So what do we want to do about it, John?
They're embedding software. This is how the thing happened in Canada, because they bought a system from China, and they found embedded software in there that was talking back to the Chinese about all the data that was going through. I forget what that was called, but
well, we're always testing each other.
Yes.
We're always prodding, pushing into the various systems. So the question really is offense and defense. Who's stronger and who's got the will? Because if, in fact, the Russians decided that they figured out how to take out, let's just say, the East Coast of the United States, arguably the nerve center, Washington, D.C., New York City, Boston. I mean, if they decided to do that, what would our response likely be if we couldn't get it up and running for 6 months?
Right. Well, first we'd have to figure out where it was coming from, because it's easy to mask yourself.
But it's not that 400-pound guy on the couch. Let's assume that. All right. But there's all kinds of ugly outcomes that we can imagine. Now, we have conventions related to nuclear devices. Now, some of these treaties and these conventions are things that, well, do they really hold up over time? We pull out of some because we think somebody's cheating. But we don't really have anything quite like that in the cyber world. And it would seem as if we're going to get together as a world of nations, we should get together around nuclear devices, climate change, and we should get together around cyber.
Well, I mean, let's face it, though, the first two are easy to monitor. Cyber is one that can be done almost anywhere. And how do you monitor that? How do you know that somebody is actually...
Well, look at the election system. I mean, whether we agree that the Trump administration or at that time the campaign was woven into this, we know what the Russians did. I mean, if you look at the Mueller report, he names the people involved. He indicted the generals and others at their cyber command center that they were running this operation.
Well, this is why I'm glad, at least in Connecticut, everybody should have paper ballots, because you really can't, because of our atmosphere we're in, trust these total machines that are totally electric, that there's no backup.
But unfortunately, because, John, we have 20-year-old machines that are now already obsolete.
Right, but at least we have that paper backup.
Yeah. I'm less worried. I'm worried about elections, don't get me wrong, but I'm worried about daily living. I'm worried about them really pushing us back into the Stone Age. Now, we could push them back into the Stone Age, but what do we achieve if both nations are back in the Stone Age?
Nothing.
So we've got to become more cyber resilient, and we need more cooperation between private and public sectors. Now, don't forget, that's been an issue too, because the private sector in America is pretty darn sophisticated, whether it's Silicon Valley and others. And how do we work together to avoid these types of crises that lead to the next hot war?
And the big problem is our government is always much slower to come on board with new technology, because I think a lot of times they don't understand it. There's a lot of misunderstanding. They don't. So to come up with laws and stuff that start protecting us takes a long time.
Well, I'll tell you, we are so lucky on the podcast today. There's a new book by Richard A. Clarke. Now, Richard A. Clarke is one of the leading experts on security, cyberspace, terrorism, and he served in the U.S. government for 30 years, including as White House counterterrorism coordinator under Bill Clinton and George W. Bush, and Robert Kanacki. And Robert is with us on the podcast. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, and together they have worked on this book called The Fifth Domain, defending our country, our companies, and ourselves in the age of cyber threats. Nobody better than this. That's the kind of guest that we are so proud to bring you.
This is important information, too.
Absolutely.
Nobody's reporting on it.
Here we are on America Trends.
With me on the line is Robert Kanacki. He, along with Richard Clarke, have written a new book, The Fifth Domain, Defending Our Country, Our Companies, and Ourselves in the Age of Cyber Threats. And, of course, you wrote the book about 10 years ago called Cyber War. And in it, you predicted that these threats would grow, involve the military and such. A lot of people at that time, Rob, didn't really understand what was transpiring here, because it's hard to see. But you were right in so many ways. And what has evolved over the last 10 years to bring you to the point where you've written this new book, The Fifth Domain?
So I think two points. One is that the threats have only gotten worse. Capabilities has spread from a couple actors, from the United States, from Russia, from China, to a second group of highly sophisticated actors, North Korea, Iran, and others, as well as the growth of a criminal capability that is almost as good as the best nation state capabilities. So that's the threat front. On the other front, on the security side, things have actually gotten better. So if the threats have gotten worse, the ability to defend against them has greatly improved over the last decade. And that's something that we didn't see coming when we wrote Cyber War 10 years ago.
In the book, you talk about Bill Clinton, and he's a bit visionary in this regard, talking about the offensive advantage and the offensive preference versus the defense, which is always seemingly trying to catch up. Do you want to help us understand, in the world of cyber war, what offense and defense really mean, and the importance of having an advantage?
from the time that computers were first invented and really when they started to be networked together, there has been a view that attackers on the internet had an advantage, that it was easier to attack than to defend. And so if you talk to a chief information security officer in, say, 2008, you'd probably hear the same story from many of them. And it'd be something along the lines of this. I've got 400,000 computers that I need to defend. They're using all kinds of different operating systems. They're at all different patching levels. An attacker's going to find a way to get in. The attacker's only got to get in once. I've got to be right all the time. The attacker has such a huge advantage. And that was the story 10 years ago. Now what's happening, thanks to technology and thanks to changes in thinking, is the industry is starting to say, well, actually, the attacker's got to be right. They've got to be in sequence. They've got to get through multiple different tools, multiple different technologies. I've only got to capture them at one stage in this chain. And if I stop them or detect them at one stage in this chain, I win, they lose. And that's the shift that's happening, and the technologies are helping make that possible.
You say that the government and private companies are starting to catch up on a defensive front to this issue, and yet we've all read and heard how discombobulated our government is at a time. We remember when the private companies and the government couldn't get together to decide whether they should share information to help one another. And so as we look at the dysfunction, particularly in Washington, why would we, the American public, believe that things are getting better when, in fact, today's the day when I think it's Experian, you know, reminded us that they had lost or been hacked and 150 million of us, our information went somewhere, and they are now being fined $700 million. So the public's perception of this problem is that it's affecting us personally and that the government can't get out of its own way to even begin to deal with this.
In some ways, this is a question of the dog that didn't bark. We tell the story of NotPetya, which was Russian malware released on Ukraine that got into many global multinational companies that were operating in Ukraine, including the shipping company Maersk, the drug company Merck, and the food maker Mondelez, and caused billions of dollars worth of damage. But there are dozens of multinational companies that operate in Ukraine that use the software that was the intrusion vector for that attack, and they were resilient to it. They managed their way through it. It didn't shut down production at those companies. And so those are the stories that we try and highlight in the book. 10 years ago, we didn't really have awareness of this kind of capability because we weren't very good at detecting it. Most companies couldn't tell if the Russians were in their network, or for that matter, whether the NSA were in their network. When we wrote Cyber War, we quoted a general in the U.S. intelligence community who said, you know, we carry out X number of attacks every month. We never get caught. Well, no official at NSA could possibly make that claim today. Semantic, FireEye, CrowdStrike, these companies are making a cottage industry out of catching the best nation-state attackers in the world, day in and day out. And so that's the good news story. The bad news story is that so many of these companies aren't taking this threat seriously. We're saying it's possible. We think it's evidence. There's evidence out there that you can manage this threat. And yet a lot of companies, Equifax being a prime example, haven't been motivated to protect their data, to protect their systems in the way that they should.
The book, The Fifth Domain, I think we should go back and explain what that means. It's a term coined by the military.
Sure. So if you think from sort of the dawn of warfare on, right, warfare began on land. That's the first domain. Then it moved to sea. That's the second domain. Then it moved to air, the third domain, and then to space, the fourth domain. So the fifth domain is the Pentagon's term for cyberspace.
And you say this is man-made. so man can control it. And yet, I don't know if there are any treaties in place looking for us and others to call a truce or to recognize the implications. For example, if we decided to take out the electrical grid in Russia and they decided to return the favor, I mean, we could both be blown back into the Stone Age. I mean, who would benefit from that? Well, maybe China. But the implications are so enormous when we think about it.
Yeah, and so I think when we look at this issue, for much of the time that people have been wrestling with cybersecurity and cyber warfare, there's been this desire to go back to some form of Cold War stability, right? So the idea is, okay, how can we apply, say, containment or deterrence theory, the concepts that kept peace during the Cold War? How can we take those ideas and put them in place now? And when we look at cyber, we think that that's probably the wrong approach. When we look at Russia, we know, thanks to the Director of National Intelligence testimony from this winter, that the U.S. government is of the view that Russia is in our power grid and has the capability to take it down at least locally and at least for short periods of time. We know that. We know, thanks to very purposeful press releases, that the U.S. government is inside Russia's power grid and probably has the capability to take that power grid down. The problem is Vladimir Putin does not care about the citizens in Moscow the same way that Donald Trump cares about the citizens in Washington, D.C. or New York City. When you're operating outside of a democracy with a threat like this, Putin is not going to withhold using it because he's afraid of the consequences of blowback on his people, right? One of the things that we write in the book is that you have to remember that up to a quarter of Russian citizens don't have indoor plumbing. So turning out the power in Russia really isn't going to have that same impact that it would if you turned out the power in the United States.
So you're taking a country that arguably doesn't have the military power and strength that we do, and giving them something that puts them on par in terms of the impact that they could have on the average American citizen. Why hasn't he perhaps tested that? He certainly tested it in the course of our elections.
So what we've seen is that he has tested his capability twice now in Ukraine in what to us look very much like test runs, right? There's no reason that if Russia wants to cause harm in Ukraine, they would use a cyber capability to do that. They practically own the country. So from that perspective, we see those two attacks as simply planning for an attack on the United States. What hasn't happened are the geopolitical circumstances in which Putin would calculate that that is in fact something he wants to do, that it makes sense to turn out the power in the United States. Now, of course, that's not an uncommon phenomenon in warfare, right? He also has a nuclear capability, which, thank God, he has not chosen to use because he has not found it to be in his interest, right? There are lots of weapons that, until the time comes where it makes sense to use them from some actor's perspective, they go unused.
You do say in the book that when the offense has the advantage, we're likely to have conflict. Is that where we are today? And again, as we see these defenses building and you making us feel a little bit better that our private companies and our government actually are responding if we don't see it all the time and only see those things that get through. So is this the moment for a country like Russia or China before our defensive abilities really are emboldened even further and bolstered to perhaps think about attacking the U.S.?
Right. So, you know, this is the part of the book where we went from policy wonks to political scientists and really looked at the literature on what makes conflict more likely. And it turns out that if you want to predict whether or not war is likely to happen, the best way to do that is to understand this question of offense or defense. In periods where there's a perception that the offense has an advantage, it's more likely that you're going to end up in conflict. It's a very simple theory. It turns out to be a very predictive and a very accurate one. So from that sense, we're in a dangerous period right now because the perception is that offense has the advantage and that therefore is a first mover advantage, that if you're going to strike, you want to strike, you want to take out the power, you want to take out the internet, you want to cause harm while you can. And if you do that, you may be able to stop your adversary from doing the same thing to you. So it's a very unstable period. Our hope is that as defense improves, it will become recognized that it's actually not as easy as people think it is. It's not as effective as it currently is now, and we'll reach a period of much greater stability.
What did the 2016 elections and the interference by the Russians and our response to it tell the Russians about America in this era of cyber threats?
So I think that the thing that Russia really learned from it is we don't have good tools for deterring them, right? I spent a lot of time in the administration, in the Obama administration, focused on what we do about China's threat to the United States, which then was really about stealing intellectual property, stealing technology on the internet and giving it to Chinese national champion companies, right? So this economic espionage was the thing. What we knew then was that we actually had a lot of levers over China. We had a huge trade relationship. We had common interests in the Pacific region. There were a lot of things on the agenda that China cared about, and there were a lot of things that we could threaten, including simply their claim to be a world leader, right? The more that we pressed on China by saying, hey, you know, you want to say that you're a world leader and yet you're a kleptocracy, that had an effect. What I think Russia learned is we don't have that much leverage over them. And that's because they're a weak and diminishing power. That's because they don't have the traditional military capabilities. They don't have an economy that is appealing to U.S. multinationals. U.S. citizens don't want to buy Russian goods, maybe except for vodka, and Tito's is pretty good now. So from that perspective, we don't have a lot of leverage over the Russians. And I think that's one thing that they realized in this engagement. So right now it's about how do we figure out what are those kind of levers that we can have over Russia leading up to 2020 and beyond.
Robert Kanacki is with us. He, along with Richard Clark, and they've been in the national security domain for a long time, have written a book, The Fifth Domain. We're talking about cybersecurity. You say that we are already engaged in a low-grade, simmering cyber conflict with Russia, China, and Iran. And as we look at Iran today, and we see tensions heightening with Iran, is this a moment for them, given the fact that they don't have the military strength to go up against the United States if we really deploy it, though it's been difficult for us, of course, in the Middle East theater. Is this possibly one of the areas where we could see the cyber threat, you know, in its most immediate sense, or would they be reluctant to use it because, again, as you suggest, this can't lead to a military hot war conflict?
Well, so, I mean, we've already seen the Iranians engage in offensive cyber operations. They carried out sustained attacks against the banks from 2011 through to 2013. And these were distributed denial of service attacks just aimed at flooding bank websites so you couldn't access your account online. And they did that then. And they also, around that time, engaged in a series of more destructive attacks against targets in the Middle East, against RasGas, which is a gas company, and against Saudi Aramco. So we've seen them engage in this kind of activity before. They've been testing and improving their offensive capabilities. No doubt that as conflict escalates, we will see the Iranians carry out offensive cyber operations against the United States. It's easier for them to reach the United States and cause consequences in the United States in cyberspace than in any other domain. What's really, really interesting from my perspective is that President Trump actually used cyber as a means to de-escalate over the downing of the drone. his military leaders came to him with a kinetic response that would have, I think, in his estimation, caused 150 casualties, and he backed down and said, no, go do something in cyberspace. And so that was actually, cyber was used as a de-escalatory mechanism.
And do you think that it can serve in that function as kind of a precursor, such that we can de-escalate some of the tensions around the world, or is that a risky business as well?
Well, I mean, the danger is that, you know, you think you're de-escalating and your adversary thinks you're escalating, right? In cyberspace, one of the things we know is there's an unpredictability to what happens. So you think you're doing one thing that's going to cause one level of consequence, and you actually cause another level of consequence. For a long time in the Pentagon, the sort of knock against offensive cyber operations was this issue of predictability, right? You can calculate very precisely what is the yield, what is the impact if you drop a bomb. You can't necessarily do that with a cyber attack. And so from that perspective, it can be de-escalatory, but if things go wrong, what you may think you have calibrated to be a response that will be felt, but felt in just the right amount, can get out of control.
And what about the issue of plausible deniability, that at times we don't know who's doing this? If we're talking about President Trump, he said, well, during the 2016 elections, it could have been a 400-pound guy on his couch in the basement. I mean, so how good are we at knowing the origin of these attacks?
So, I mean, if you read the Mueller report, if you read the indictment of the five Chinese PLA actors that were responsible for a campaign against U.S. companies stealing intellectual property, we've gotten pretty good at attribution in cyberspace. I mean, in the case of the five PLA, we're not just saying this was the Chinese government. We're not just saying this is a Chinese ministry. We're saying it's these five PLA officers. Here are their pictures. Here are their handles online. Here's the building they work in. So from that perspective, I think the idea that attribution in cyberspace is impossible is wrong. It's hard. It takes time. But you use multiple means, you're able usually to figure out who's doing something. I can't recall a single time in my government service in which we really just had no idea who was responsible for an attack. Attribution has gotten much, much better. The other thing I would say is we're well past the time when a single 400-pound guy in a basement is able to carry out this kind of attack, right? These are coordinated. They take multiple skill sets. It's just like any other technology startup, right? You're going to need your specialists in five or six different technical domains to carry something like that out, and no single person's going to be able to do it. So that's one way that we've seen the offensive advantage eroding.
Well, I guess I won't take the president at his face value word any longer. When we look at things like blackouts, and we just had one in New York, train derailments, airplane crashes, is there an area, particularly for a sophisticated nation like ours, that is driven by so many of these aspects, and they're so important to our economy and our survival? Are there any one of these attacks or any combination of them that would seem to cross a line that would be difficult for that country to cross back over without finding the American military ultimately getting involved?
So, I mean, I think at the point at which a cyber attack causes the equivalent of a kinetic attack in terms of life lost or economic impact, that's when you're going to see the U.S. military respond outside of cyberspace. Now, it's been policy going back to the Clinton administration that the United States reserves the right to respond in any domain to a cyber attack. So there should be no assumption that if we're attacked in cyberspace, say somebody knocks out the electric grid during a heat wave in Chicago and kills 600 people who die of heat stroke, that the U.S. military is only going to respond in kind in cyberspace. I think that's a situation in which you very much are likely to see a kinetic response.
When we hear about cyberspace and cyber threats, we always talk about America defending against them. How aggressive are we. I think a lot of people misinterpret the United States. We are not someone who sits back and watches things unfold. We can be very aggressive on our own. What is our offensive capability, and how are we deploying it at this moment in time around the world?
I don't want to get too USA here, but I mean, I think it's safe to say that the United States has the best offensive capability in the world, right? Our offensive actors really are second to none in terms of organization, in terms of discipline, in terms of training, and in terms of the capability that they can have. So I think that's true. What we've seen is in the past a reluctance to open up the cyber warfare domain past administrations. In this administration, we're seeing a desire to really see how we can not only use the capability, but talk about it. So give the equivalent of a bomb damage assessment. Say, you know, we've carried out this capability and here's what we think we've done. We saw the Pentagon do this around the midterm elections, wherein they targeted the Internet Research Agency and purportedly shut off Internet connectivity to this Russian group of trolls around the election to try and stymie their abilities to interfere in the midterms. So I think that's good that we're A, trying to use this capability, and B, that we're trying to talk about it in order to, in some fashion, create deterrence. In the long run, I think what we're finding from these experiences, and some of these experiences go back to the Obama administration, is, you know, the utility of offensive cyber operations for counteroffense is fairly limited. It's not that easy to take out the capability of a foreign adversary in cyberspace, right? This sort of force on force. It's much easier to go after a less well-defended civilian target. And that's the fear. That's the concern that we see, is that we're going to see much more targeting of civilian infrastructure than going straight after, say, a military unit.
You do say in the book that a cyber moonshot is somewhat silly, you know, the whole idea that let's spend enough money and commit ourselves enough to making certain that we are never at the other end of an attack. Why is a moonshot idea not practical?
Well, I mean, so the problem with this idea, you know, it comes up in many forms, right? We need a cyber moonshot, or we need a cyber Manhattan project. And what we say in the book is nobody has yet been able to define what's the target, right? So with the moonshot, we knew what the target was. It was to put a man on the moon. Well, what are you actually trying to do with cybersecurity? What is that goal that you have, right? What we talk about in the book is that cybersecurity is really a process of ongoing improvement, where you're always trying to get better and you're trying to get your defenses better faster than the attacker gets their capabilities better and faster. And so from that perspective, you're never going to be done with cybersecurity. It's not like the Manhattan Project, where there's a physics equation that you just got to make tangible in the real world. That's not where we are in cybersecurity. And so, well, you know, what we say in the book is, like, you know, we know what the solutions look like. We know what secure is. We know what resilient is. We need to build towards that company by company, agency by agency, even down to the individual level. And so a lot of the book is about how do we get the incentives right to get private companies to make those investments.
You also say that private companies oftentimes are incredulous that it's their responsibility to defend their companies against foreign adversaries. They think, isn't it the military's responsibility? And I know Richard Clark, your co-author and a good friend, has designed this public-private partnership model. Put both of those issues in context for us.
Sure. So, I mean, a lot of the time, I think this is a fairly standard response in boardrooms, right? You know, the FBI will come knocking on a major bank's door and say, okay, you know, the Russians are inside your network. Here's what we think they're going after. Here's the tactics and techniques they're using. Here's the indicators of compromise you can use to find them. Good luck. And then the bank will say, wait, hold on. You're telling me this is a Russian, this is a foreign intelligence agency that is targeting me, a bank, because I'm a symbol of U.S. power, and your response is to share information with me? Isn't it your job to stop them? Isn't it your job to arrest them? Isn't it your job to shoot them? And the answer is, well, you know, no. And the reason for that is that we've built cyberspace as really as a civilian domain, as a commercial space in which data flows freely, and the government doesn't have choke points, doesn't have the capability to shut off bad traffic, and we wouldn't want them to, because if they could shut off the bad traffic, they could also look at all the traffic. And many times we see in foreign governments arguments for cybersecurity that are really about censorship and they're really about surveillance. So the Great Firewall of China is China's system for controlling its internet. And using the term firewall suggests that it's for security, when what it's really about is watching and controlling what their citizens do online. It has almost no utility for cybersecurity. It's not something that the guys up at Fort Meade at NSA are sitting around saying, gee, how are we going to get around the Great Firewall of China today? That's not what it's for. So giving government the ability, the mission for cybersecurity, you have to give government access to all the data flowing over the internet and into your company. And that's something that we wouldn't want. It's also something that really wouldn't be effective. When we look at what's cutting edge in cybersecurity today, it's happening on each and every individual computer, right? So if you saw the IPO of CrowdStrike, which has gone up hugely since it IPO'd last month, that company makes all its money by sitting on actual computers and looking for threats. That's not something that any CEO wants the U.S. government to do.
When we look at it, the digital economy is growing, I think, three times the rate of the rest of the economy. I mean, how vital is it that we get all of this right? And should we take some comfort in the fact that you and Richard Clark say that there has been a degree of continuity across administrations, and this is rarely seen in other policy areas, and yet many of us think that the Trump administration has gone rogue in so many ways.
So, you know, we see, you brought up the term public-private partnership earlier, right? Within the cybersecurity community, you say public-private partnership, and people just roll their eyes because they've been hearing about it for 20 years, and it's like, oh, God, not that again. We have to come up with a new strategy. But, you know, what we argue in the book is this idea that government's going to work with the private sector, but the private sector is going to be in the lead. It's going to be responsible for protecting itself. And then government will do only the things that government can do, like investigate crimes on a very bad day, carry out offensive operations, collect intelligence, create incentives for good cybersecurity and disincentives for bad cybersecurity, that we have these very specific roles. And this is an incredibly novel way to think about a security problem, right? This is the opposite of how we think about terrorism. It's the opposite of how we think about nuclear deterrence. And yet it's really the only viable option. So, you know, when we look at the growth of the digital economy, our view is if you take the value that we get from bringing systems online, from automation, you recognize how hugely valuable this has been to our economy. And all we need to do is plow back a small percentage of that value that we've gained into securing it. It's well worth it.
In the book, The Fifth Domain, you say that there are many policy recommendations that you'd like to see the American government undertake. There are many legislative remedies that are being proposed. Is there anything on the horizon that you think would be really important to maintain cyber peace or to give America the defensive capabilities that it needs?
So, you know, the most important thing is to get companies to value their own systems and then to protect them to an adequate level. So there's legislation on the Hill right now that would have companies that hold individual personal data have to place a value on that data, have to say, okay, we think this data is worth X billions of dollars. And that's the first step, because then when you do that, then you can say, okay, we know what it's worth. What are you spending to protect it? do you have insurance policies that would pay out to those individual consumers the value that they're going to lose if their data is released onto the dark web? And if you had a system like that, then companies would be incentivized either to get rid of a lot of that data or, alternatively, to protect it. And so from that perspective, I think that's one of the more important ideas out there. On the international stage, we argue in the book that we need to start thinking about the global internet in a very different way. And this is absolute hypocrisy within the internet community. There was a belief that if you connected regimes like China, regimes like Russia, to the global internet, that the openness would infect societies, that information would lead to freedom. And this was sort of the gospel of the early internet. That turns out, obviously, not to be the case. These regimes have become very good at controlling the internet, limiting access, and the internet, instead of becoming this beacon of freedom, has actually become the backbone for the surveillance states that we're seeing emerge. And so from that perspective, what we argue in the book is that we need to stop thinking about openness as the solution and then start thinking about how we can create barriers to access to Western markets, how we can unify the digital economy between the United States, Canada, our European and other allies around the world, and start saying, okay, we're going to act as a single block where internet traffic will freely flow between us, where digital goods will be freely traded between us, and then start making it harder for, say, a Chinese company to both participate in that economy as well as steal from it. We think that's the shift that we need to see over the next decade, and the way we would do that really would be through trade as a mechanism to limit access to our digital markets.
Do you think that some of the measures that are being undertaken by the Trump administration are in that direction and recognizing what it is that you're saying about what has happened with the internet?
So, you know, I think, you know, neither Dick nor I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I don't think either of us would argue with the decision on Huawei. It seems to be the right decision, right? And it's a pretty simple test in our mind that the Trump administration has devised, where they said, okay, you know, is this a technology that represents a national security threat because it can give access to vital information, yes or no? If it can, okay, that's a problem. Then the second question is the company that provides the technology under the thumb of one of our adversaries, yes or no? And if the answer is yes, their argument is it's a national security threat and it should have extreme limitations put on it in terms of access to U.S. markets and certainly access to critical infrastructure and U.S. government systems. And so I think Huawei was the right call. I think Kaspersky, which was a Russian antivirus company that was banned from selling to the U.S. government, was the right call. The question is, what are we doing about the thousands of other technologies and dozens of other companies that pose similar threats? I don't think what we have now is a fully coherent, fully baked out strategy for dealing with these technologies and for the repercussions of trying to ban them. We're very dependent on a global supply chain to run our economy, and that introduces a series of threats and a series of problems that we really don't know how to address at this point.
Robert Kanacki, along with Richard Clark. The book is called The Fifth Domain, Defending Our Country, Our Companies, and Ourselves in the Age of Cyber Threats. Thank you so much, Robert, for joining us today on America Trends.
My pleasure. Thank you.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network, mhnrnetwork.com.